September 16th, 2013.
This is the first session. The last one we've seen by the first session is by the introductory session. So we now begin the first of what will be 14 sessions, 7 this term and 7 the next term. And the format is as follows. Our two speakers are going to present distillations of their papers. So they'll speak for no more than about 15 minutes. I will introduce Bob Ramakers. Vernon will begin by introducing Gregory Blomquist, and then Vernon will introduce our respondent, Harry Meyer. And after that response, the discussion will open up to embrace all of you. So without further ado, Vernon, could you make the first introduction?
Certainly. Is this what you're going to say?
I'm supposed to stand over there.
Can I get a photo? Right
here, I'm going to go there.
No, I did something. I'm going to
stand.
I was just trying to record.
That'd be great.
Welcome. It's my pleasure to introduce you Professor L. Gregory Blomquist. He goes by Greg. We had a little fun with it earlier. He has a friend who calls him L, so L. Gregory. L. Grego, you know. But But he's Professor of Holy Scripture at St. Paul University in Ottawa, Canada. And he's been there, I thought I knew, since 1987, after receiving his doctorate at University of Toronto and Toronto School of Theology. He spent some years, five was it, as visiting professor in Barcelona?
Barcelona, you got it right. Barcelona, you got Catalan right.
Good, okay. I met him in 1995 at a London rhetoric conference, and we started working together, and he's always been a leader in theory and reading further into the theory of cognitive theory about visualization. And he would lead us forward, and then when we would take him seriously and work it up, then he would put pressure on us that we weren't doing it right to deepen it. So he has theoretical essays on sociological things, rhetorical, apocalyptic, healing, ideological issues, in the midst of his book on function of suffering in Philippians, and then three very important edited books, one on vision and persuasion, focused on apocalyptic in 1999, another one focused on ideological texture in Romans 1, and just recently, he has completed a translation of the Wisdom of Solomon that was to accept the challenge of images and thinking of eighth graders for the elegant kind of writing in Wisdom of Solomon. He talked about the challenge of that a little bit this morning. But we welcome you, Greg, for your paper, Eyes Wide Open, Seeing Nothing, right? And then further comment about visualization in the Gospel of John. Welcome.
So I was partway into my sermon, and the point that I wanted to make with great illustration, I was partway through that, and I saw in the back pew some commotion. Someone motioned me on. And so I continued, and then I saw more commotion as my illustration continued. Within a few minutes, there were sirens, ambulance, and I was continually motioned on during this whole period of time. But as it turned out, the illustration that I had given had caused one of the young people in the church to faint. So as I was leaving the setting that morning, the church that I regularly preach in, one of the elders said to me, he said, "Pastor, next time use less vivid imagery." My students in the Gospel of John never have that difficulty. The beginning of the Gospel of John, which I set for them, is something that I set for you in the paper. And it undertakes an exercise from socio-rhetorical interpretation, which is to start at the beginning of a text and identify the imagery elicited by the text. There's nothing vivid about the Word, about God, about light, about life. It's actually an impossible task. Brennan Robbins has made a not-so-radical idea that picturing through rhetoric and for the purposes of rhetoric is primary rather than logical argumentation. And he's given us abundant tools to identify how that picturing works in texts. These are approaches to what we call the texture of texts. These tools are revealing within texts aspects of the text that we had not seen before, and they're doing so in ways that accord with some recent insights from neurophysiology, cognitive science, and other areas. In the paper, I touch on four areas. The first is physiology of visualization, which suggests that we have a large amount of stuff from ocular sources, but actually a minimal amount of actually usable information, and the fact that the mind must make sense of what we see. The second point is that memory is the key to the primary sources in play, in meaning-making. It's comprised of material gain through ocular resources, as well as a confluence of material from other resources, including those that are innate to the mind itself. These resources are both individual and corporate, for there is some memory that is unique to the individual, but there is some memory that is social, either because that is the way the mind is made or because of learned behavior from culture, even learned, as we saw this morning, from only one input experience, in the case, for example, of taste. How the mind works is by using, thirdly, how the mind works is by using the stuff of memory to blend elements in the mind, be it visual stimuli or primarily memory, to make meaning through highly complex blending of elements within the mind already. Some of these materials are in the mind knowingly. But fourth, other materials are in the mind unknowingly, either through the process of intuition or through adverted or inadvertent encounters. Adverted, that is, something which attention is paid to, encounters are what we are dealing with in rhetorical address, where I bring something to your attention by speech. Inadvertent encounters are the encounters of which we are most often unaware, but that shape our minds. These may be daily activities like driving a car for which we do not even think what we need to do, or they might be inadvertent encounters planted for us or that occur and cause our minds to reconfigure interpretation. I am introduced along with another person named George, and suddenly the host begins to refer to me as George as well as the other person, inadvertently. Or you see the HP on my computer cover as opposed to an Apple. And your mind is fixed. But do you know how it might affect your reception of what I'm saying right now? Are you aware that it has or that it might have? The lighting in this room, are you aware of it, or is it inadvertent? Does it affect the way you receive what's being said today, the way I'm dressed? The smell from the person sitting next to you, which reminds you of... John's Gospel presents some unique problems. From verse 1 all the way to the 20th and last chapter, for the application of any tools, be it from socio-rhetorical interpretation or from the sciences that I've mentioned. John's Gospel appears to begin with the unvisualizable, the invisible. Again and again throughout the Gospel, characters are cautioned against trusting in the visible and the visualizable. Is this because the Gospel is a poetic exaltation of the invisible, or a philosophical presentation of the invisible form that lies behind what is visible? Neither of these seems very likely. Rather, it seems to be because this text begins in agreement with one of the most profound aspects of Yahwistic religion, namely, that God, while knowable, is invisible. Furthermore, this text asserts that there will be some who will be offspring of this God. But if this God is invisible, are the offspring also invisible? They move like the wind, which is invisible. But if they are invisible, only heard, like God and like the wind, what would a world that is inhabited by offspring that are invisible in this world, what would that world look like? How would it be different from this world? Clues to what that world looks like exist in the form of cultural memory artifacts, primarily the Jewish scriptures. But they are only clues, and they're profoundly elusive. Perhaps the teachers of the scriptures can help. But when we go to the temple where they are to be found, the teachers of the scriptures, and we only find that they are of no help. In fact, when we go there, we find that they are the problem. Offspring or God are what the temple in Jerusalem was to produce, but it has not. It has failed the people whom God led forth from Egypt. Perhaps the temple has stopped doing it at some point. Perhaps the temple never was able to produce real offspring. Through analysis of the textures in the Gospel of John, we realize that what is being presented is an elaborate cognitive network in which the temple is a kind of womb that is intended to produce divine offspring, but that because of its own lack of purity cannot. Instead, it holds humans within its sphere, keeping them blinded, as if they were still in a womb, unable to see, and not yet fully human. Rather than unborn children who will help the others to be born, or midwives bringing forth the children, the temple personnel and those who are closest to them have veiled the truth, both of the temple's emptiness of God and of the possibility that another, Jesus, may speak the word of God. The last scene of the gospel provides a profoundly ironic depiction of a temple image in the form of an empty tomb with a slab guarded by two angelic beings, one at either end of the slab, but that is now empty of the word, even as the temple is empty of the word which made it the temple in the first place. A temple that purports to be the ongoing source of light and life for Israel, especially at the Feast of Tabernacles, is in fact darker than the tomb in which the body of Jesus had lain. At least Mary, who is no priest, sees the emptiness and knows now where not to look. Does the reader? I thought long and hard about the imagery that has reflected something of the rhetography found in John, and I think it's minimal. That is, the actual artistic depictions that pick up on the rhetography as we've explored it in the paper. I think it's a very minimal amount. I do think that Byzantine art is profoundly influenced by the rhetography of John, but in the way I describe in the paper. But I also think that I see something reflected as well in the moving scenes from François Girard's movie The Red Violin. I don't know how many of you have seen it. Great Canadian film. Backgrounded by John Corigliano's stirring score, the movie tells the story of a 17th century violin maker, Busotti, whose last violin is varnished with blood taken from his beautiful and much-loved wife, who has died in childbirth with their only child. The blood-drenched violin travels from generation to generation and land to land, creating scandal and being violated until it lands in the home of the one man who knows its story and loves the violin. The blood-drenched violin, it's called the Red Violin for that reason. The blood-drenched violin is home where it is loved. The word, blood-drenched from his true birth from the tomb, is never home in the world. He is not home until he rests fully in the bosom of the Father, undefiled, where he feeds only on the words that he hears rising up within the Father's breast, deep from the Father's heart. And on those words, he and the other children with him feed for all eternity.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased now to introduce our second speaker. And Bart Ramakers is professor of historical Dutch literature at the University of Groningen.
He specializes in the dramatic literature and performance of the Netherlandish Chambers of Rhetoric, and especially on the relation amongst theater, visual art, and humanism. He is the author of Plays and Figures, Stagecraft and Processional Culture in Oudenaarde between the Middle Ages and the Modern Period, and editor of Conformists and Rebels, Rhetorical Culture in the Netherlands, 1400 to 1650. Upon the summit of the Dutch Parnassus, the rhetorical competition of 1616 in Vlaardingen. This came out in 2006. And Understanding Art in Antwerp, Classicizing the Popular, Popularizing the Classic, 1540 to 1580. This came out in 2011. He is also co-editor of Play and Spectacle, The Medieval Stage in the Low Countries, and Actors and Actions, Figures and Types of Action in the Drama of the Early Modern Period. His 8-volume co-edited series, Trouw moet blijken, source edition of the books of the Haarlem Rhetorical Chamber, De Pelikanisten, is a monument of the new literary philology and a rich and as yet untapped source of material for art historians. My students, please pay attention to that. The paper circulated for today's meeting is entitled Discerning Vision, Cognitive Strategies in Cornelis Everaerts, Mary Compared to the Light of circa 1511. But
if you don't mind, I stand behind the pulpit. I never get the chance to do that, so you all do or will eventually.
In any other colloquium, it would be the podium. In this one, it's the pulpit.
Among the extensive dramatic oeuvre of the Bruges playwright Cornelis Everaerts are four so-called comparations, comparaties, we say in Dutch. These are dramatized comparisons between an object of devotion on the one hand and a sacred biblical object or an object known from daily life or even a living creature on the other. The plays were performed in the early decades of the 16th century during theatrical competitions linked to a series of processions held in the Flemish coastal towns of Nieuwpoort and Veurne. As theater, these plays combine word and image. The latter not only manifests itself in personifications, particularly in their costumes and attributes, in their mimicry and gestures, as well as in their overall action on stage, but also in the use of living images, or tableaux vivants, which served argumentative, devotional, and mnemonic purposes. In one of the comparisons, the play of Mary compared to the light, the comparison is experienced non-visually, as the mankind character in this play is blind. His name is Imaginative Mind. The condition that makes it impossible for him to see either comparans or comparandum, but does allow him and even stimulates him to imagine their characteristics and qualities through the description and explanation by his discussants, illustrates that seeing and understanding in these plays are not just a matter of corporal sight, but also, or maybe even primarily, a matter of spiritual sight, the function of the internal senses, imagination being one of them. This kind of seeing could lead man from earthly wisdom to divine wisdom, that is, from scientia to sapientia. At the end of the play, Imaginative Mind is called to witness a tableau vivant in which the comparison culminates. The depiction of Mary standing between heaven and earth as mediatrix between the Trinity, which is enthroned above, and mankind situated below. Three rays of light coming from the mouth of the three divine persons shine down on Mary's head, while a fourth ray coming from her own mouth descends to earth. Imaginative Mind is explicitly invited to open his eyes and watch this spectacle. However, there is no indication in the text that Imaginative Mind has suddenly been cured of his blindness. On the contrary, I believe he has entered a stage of spiritual vision, of inner sight. The image in question was particularly adequate to stimulate such vision. It was inspired by the woman from Revelations 12, verse 1 to 6, the Bible book Augustine characterized as a prime example of spiritual, or as it was also called, imaginative vision. The intermediate level in his tripartite theory of vision between corporal sense generated and intellectual, spirited vision. This tableau vivant is an example of what Sixten Ringbaum calls an imaginative devotion in his famous 1969 article. Ringbaum argues that miniatures depicting Mary and the Son function as apparitions to the owners of the medieval books of ours in which they featured. These people were no mystics or visionaries to whom Mary had really appeared. They merely envisaged such scenes as part of their devotional life, imagining them and having them painted in their prayer books as if they were real visions. Imaginative mind is being advised by three characters, personifications like him, who each fulfill a clearly demarcated role in accordance with the kind of argument or reasoning they represent. I now even wonder whether their function can be linked to the three levels of vision distinguished by Augustine, that is, corporal, imaginative, and the intellectual vision. The first of these characters is called experiential proof. That Everard aimed for a truly scientific analogy, this character makes clear not only through his name, but also through his sustained analysis of light on the basis of scientific observation, that is, on the basis of knowledge received through the senses. Although he occasionally appeals to auctoritatis, he persistently describes the effect of light in empirical terms, even explicitly, by introducing them with expressions like, as we may see through experience, and then follows an observation from natural philosophy. Opposite experiential proof's physical analysis of the comparans light, the second advisor, sweet eloquence, places the theological analysis of the comparandum Mary as a personification of the art of rhetoric or poetry. She is able not only to fathom the analogy between Mary and the light, but also to phrase this analogy in a rhetorically convincing way, whereby the persuasiveness not just depends on the origin and quality of the arguments as such, but also on the quality of their poetic metaphorical expression. Sweet eloquence's name hints in their direction. Her verbal presence goes further than just providing a doctrinal interpretation of the Virgin Mary per se. She also aims at veneration. Sweet eloquence covers her arguments in laudatory expressions that contribute to an atmosphere of worship and devotion. Almost without exception, she starts her clauses with two-line exclamatory addresses consisting of the name Mary and the word clarity, like, O Mary, clarity steeped in virtue, in pure hearts, you abundantly shine. It is not sweet eloquence, however, who starts addressing Mary directly. It is the third participant in the comparation, called grounded scripture, who does so. She's not on stage from the beginning, but appears halfway through the prologue, shortly after experiential proof and sweet eloquence have lifted imaginative mind onto the stage from among the audience. The three of them start looking for her, since her presence is indispensable in order to explain the analogy. She has to provide the written basis, quotes of the prophets, doctors of the church, and liturgical prayers for the comparison between Mary and light. She addresses Mary by paraphrasing Canticles 4, verse 7. You are indeed the clarity according to the word of the canticle, fair and flawless. In fact, grounded scripture starts most of her clauses by quoting or paraphrasing a Bible book or an authority, often referring to that book's title or to that authority's name, like in Saint Bernard, filled with contemplation, says. That grounded scripture can bring forward her authoritative evidence without further introduction has to do with the fact that sweet eloquence always takes the floor before her to introduce the analogy between the natural clarity of light and the spiritual clarity of Mary. From the moment the prologue ends and the actual comparison starts, the clauses of the four characters alternate in near flawless rhythm. Of the total of 18 sequences, each devoted to one aspect of the analogy, 13 start with a question or remark by imaginative mind concerning the natural properties or effects of light. Next, experiential proofs brings forward his scientific observations, after which sweet eloquence, in a heightened tone, links these observations to Mary's redemptive powers, followed by grounded scripture, who finally underscores sweet eloquence's panegyric lines with theological references and citations. The word comparasi is obviously derived from the Latin comparatio, which, together with the use of auctoritates and exempla, was one of the techniques for setting up the extended argument of a sermon, the so-called dilatatio, with which preachers started after the central theme had been formulated and divisions and subdivisions had been made. You all know that, of course. Besides a clear definition of the thema, sermon making included the divisio, the arrangement and consequent discussion of its different aspects or parts. Other principles of composition easily recognizable in the setup of Everard's comparations are the distinctio, which was the movement from the general to the particular meanings of a term, and the pluralitatis acceptio, which meant taking into consideration the different aspects of one element with the distinction or the division which the distinction or the division had highlighted. Just as evident is the use of similes, by means of which a particular religious concept or object of devotion, like Mary, could be categorized, both in its whole and in its part. Everard's comparations also show the influence of sermon making through the application of so-called natural, figural, and scriptural argumentation by personifications that embody these different lines of reasoning. Whereas natural arguments are derived from nature, that is, from natural philosophy, scriptural arguments are obviously from the Bible or from the writings of theological authorities. Figural arguments may either refer to exempla, or literature in general, or to Old Testament references and prefigurations, both in word and image, that is, in the form of tableau vivants. Setting up analogies, establishing relationships or similitudes between material and spiritual objects was not just an intellectual exercise or game, nor was it just a handy didactic tool for catechetical instruction. However entertaining, playful, and rhetorically convincing such analogies were deemed to be, they were essentially a method of cognition within the preeminent branch of contemporary knowledge, which is to say theology, and thus formed a serious intellectual endeavor. The basis of analogical reasoning was Romans 1, verse 20, a passage from Scripture often commented upon. Ever since the creation of the world, his, that is God's, invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. Another Pauline dictum expressing this idea was 1 Corinthians 13, verse 12. But now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Thus, cognizing God literally became a form of speculation, speculatio, of mirroring. Everard's plays and those of the rhetoricians with whom he competed are part of a tradition of natural theology, and specifically of the attempt to infer the nature of God or of any other godly or saintly being, like the Virgin Mary, from what could be known about the created world. The essential capacity or faculty within man's mind or soul to make comparisons was his imagination, one of the so-called internal senses, as opposed to the external or bodily senses of sight, hearing, taste, smell, and touch. Of these five, sight no doubt took pride of place, especially in relation to intellection. It was especially its impressions on the mind, the mental representations of the external object, called species or similitudines, that were consequently converted by the interior senses into more complex representations, from which eventually the intellect distilled universal concepts, thus creating abstract thought. On the general level, where the phenomenon is represented and referred to in Everard's play, imagination designates the cognitive use of mental images. Essential for its understanding is its position in between corporal sense and abstract reason, the linchpin, as it were, between perception and understanding. Out of sensations, it formed mental pictures, which were handed over to reason for the abstraction of ideas, which in turn were stored in memory together with the sensory and mental images from which they were derived. From there, they could be retrieved and subjected to the operation of the faculty again. What that meant for the role of imagination can be deduced from the work of Thomas Aquinas. He described the likenesses of mental representations. Although he did not conceive of such likenesses as necessarily iconic, most of those describing the workings of the mind on whatever level of sophistication did so in terms of image and image making. The greatest of authorities, also in Thomas' eyes, had taken that view. In De Anima, his treatise on the soul, Aristotle states that the soul never thinks without an image. Thomas brought Aristotle's views on cognition into confrontation with those of Augustine and tried to reconcile them. In De Trinitate, the latter observed that we think in terms of images of what we have experienced. Elsewhere in this work, he stresses that the mind always relies on images. And in his Confessions, he argues that man uses his reasoning power to see intellectually your, that is, God's, invisible things by means of the things that are made. A reference to Romans 1:20, cited above. In the words of Mary Carruthers, image-making was a cognitive necessity. Human reason simply had to be led by likeness, analogy, or comparison of what could be perceived. Hence the use of metaphors, of symbols, parables, and exemplar. It was man's imagination, his associative faculty, that produced them. I would like to argue that natural theology promoted the kind of knowledge invested with experience of the visible world, which, through analogical reasoning, was connected or lifted up to the invisible realm. Affective theology may be associated with Augustine, but the role he attributed to imagination implied and stimulated his faculty's application in both rational and affective knowledge, the former leading to the latter. Imagination as analogical reasoning led man to the point where mystical contemplation began, ideally leading to union with God. That, in a way, is what we see happen in Everard's play. Although this and other comparisons follow the structure of the scholastic disputation and employ personifications that act out an argument, thus putting a rational, intellectual stamp on the genre, all this reasoning on the basis of both the natural world and scripture is driven by and towards the end of the play results in affective piety on the part of the main character, whose striving for knowledge forms the impetus for their action and offers them the opportunity to see Mary not only analogically through imagination, but also directly, in a vision, casting his inner eye past or through her at the Trinity, to which she intercedes on his behalf. As far as religious or devotional art was concerned, material images stimulated the kind of imaginative devotions or imaginative visions that Ringbohm refers to. Such imaginative visions were created by reproductive imagination, either by looking at material images, sculpted, painted, or printed, or by reading descriptions of figures or scenes of a devotional kind, sometimes of visions in the strict sense, or by retrieving such images from memory. Ringbohm's claim is that during the late Middle Ages, imaginative devotions stimulated by material imagery became part of religious lay practice as well. Everard's play thus testifies to the high level of theological as well as devotional sophistication that the urban middle classes had reached by the early 16th century. The fact that the play was written for the occasion of a widely attended urban religious festival in a well-known and broadly practiced theatrical genre and in competition with like-minded and equally spirited laymen, all trying their best to compare Mary to light, may serve as proof of the established and pervasive character of their religious ambitions, as well as of their literary prowess in expressing and further developing it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bart. And I know it's hard to suppress the desire to applaud both our presenters. And Vernon, would you introduce Harry now?
Sure. Our respondent today is Professor Harry Meyer, Professor of New Testament and Early Christian Studies at Vancouver School of Theology. After receiving his PhD at Oxford University, he joined Vancouver School of Theology as a full-time member in 1994. He held a number of prestigious fellowships, a fellow of the Alexander von Humboldt Stiftung at University of Heidelberg. He was a fellow in 1999, 2000, and then again in 2004, and a number of others. But in 2012, he's just now recently been research fellow at the Max Weber Center for Advanced Cultural and Social Studies at the University of Erfurt in Germany, where he focused on theology of place and self in early Christianity. After earlier work on the Book of Revelation and on Apocalyptic and his well-known book Apocalypse Recalled in 2002, he began to focus on empire, the relation of the function of early Christianity in the context of the Roman Empire. There's a wonderful essay called A Sly Civility, Colossians and Empire. Another one on Barbarians, Scythians, and Imperial Iconography in the Epistle of the Colossians. He just received a day ago or so a copy of his Picturing Paul in Empire, Imperial Image, Text, and Persuasion in Colossians, Ephesians, and the Pastoral Epistles, published with Bloomsbury, T.N.T. Clark. But he says it's not generally available. And he had a book, and then it disappeared. We can't see it right now. But welcome, Harry, and he's going to respond now.
Thank you. I'll talk from up here as well. You can probably see me a bit better, I hope. Professor Allmachers, you actually have answered to some degree some of the questions I was wanting to put to you, but anyway, I'll put them to you anyway. Sweet eloquence. Today's seminar papers invite us to consider the power of words to stimulate the imagination, to spark religious devotion, and paradoxically to direct vision from things visible to things invisible. In his paper on John's Gospel, Professor Bloomquist offers a reading of the Gospel from a gestational perspective, a womb with a view, if you will, which contrasts the sighted enemies of Jesus who have yet to find a second birth with the sighted ones firstborn who have or are undertaking the journey through the birth canal called the tomb womb of resurrection into the profound seeing that is not seeing according to any conventional understanding of the definition of seeing. Indeed, John promotes a seeing that is seeing what cannot be seen. In Professor Rummacher's paper, we are introduced to the world of 16th century theater, specifically Cornelius Everfert's Comparation of Mary Compared to Light, in which, quote, a creative artistic product of imagination elevates imaginative mind's understanding of Mary to the level of spiritual vision and thus completing the trajectory from scientia to sapientia. Two papers that insist upon texts that are both rich feasts for the eyes, while at the same time urging the eyesight beyond vision toward the contemplation of spiritual truths, truths which have to be believed to be seen. Sweet eloquence. The ancient handbooks outlining exercises for the practice of rhetoric, as well as more sustained discussions of rhetorical practice by authors such as Quintilian, directed that effective rhetors learn to deploy vivid speech so as to awaken participation amongst listeners. Skilled rhetors were to place the topic declaimed as though before the listener's eyes so they could see what they were hearing. Vivid speech was a means of triggering memories and with them emotions shared by both speaker and listeners, a kind of prompt to audience participation. Recently, Ruth Webb, in a sustained study of vivid or ekphrastic speech, has related Aristotelian and Stoic theories of psychology, imagination, and memory to these treatments of the role of vividness of speech and description in ancient theories of persuasion. It's interesting in that regard to notice Professor Rummacher's give reference to medieval treatments of the psychology of memory and sense perception that in some ways, though mediated through medieval philosophy, rehearses many of the same ideas found, according to Webb, at least in Aristotle, to name only one. For those of us who are not medievalists, it would be instructive to hear more about the connection between image, text, sound, and persuasion in medieval theories of rhetoric. Indeed, in the late medieval tradition, not to mention that burgeoning humanistic one contemporary with the early 16th century of Everard, preaching, whether by Meister Eckhart or by Luther himself, was evocative, steeped in vivid metaphor and delivered for maximum participation amongst listeners. The comparisons reveal a complex psychology and epistemology foreign to our own in many ways. Professor Ramakur cites, quote, "the dominant optical theory for corporeal vision, in which the soul sends out rays of light through the eyes toward the perceived object, as both stimulating and providing an analogy for supernatural vision," end quote. Out of sensation, he argues, were formed, quote, "mental pictures which were handed over to reason for the abstraction of ideas, which in turn were stored in memory together with the sensory and mental images from which they were derived," end quote. This is, interestingly, remarkably close to the ideas of Quintilian and his contemporaries, who instructed that when seeking to persuade listeners, the ideal rhetor should not depart too widely from the experience of daily things and lived experiences, so as to keep listeners from seeing things the rhetor doesn't want them to see and have experience the rhetor never wants them to have. This raises two questions, one more generally related to theological theories of cognition and the other to the culture and sociality of remembering more specifically, and most specifically to 16th century Bruges. For Roman Catholic theologians of the period, what enabled a sinful humanity to discern spiritual signification amidst the often misleading signs of the physical world? For Augustine, which Professor Omeckers notes, it is the Holy Spirit who makes the correct link between signifier and signified. I wonder if there was also a theory of psychology that developed out of this epistemology. For example, did anything survive the fall that could enable the post-lapsarian to have an innate ability to see, recognize, and at least inchoately understand what was otherwise a spiritual truth hidden to sight? This then raises the other issue that entails the social world of seeing, the politics of seeing, and the culture of seeing, the context in which the seen is rendered visible. Professor Ramakers locates the performance of Mary compared to light amidst, quote, urban middle classes, end quote, attending the urban religious festival of Corpus Christi, in which, quote, like-minded and equally spirited people were all trying their best to compare Mary to light, end quote. Such imaginative speech, one suspects, was not limited to the task of increasing devotional piety. So I'm left wondering on what other occasions and in what other contexts similarly imaginative speech was deployed so as to increase devotion and allegiance to other causes, not necessarily religious ones. When we turn to the Gospel of John, here as a scholar of New Testament and Christian origins, I'm on more familiar ground, as you can probably tell, and Professor Ramakers prompts some interesting questions to place both before the Gospel of John as well as Professor Bloomquist's paper. Here the question might be again, how can you see invisible things? What faculties must exist for this to happen? John's answer, like Augustine's, is a divine one. The Spirit blows where it wills. Quote, "no one has ever seen God, the only Son who is in the bosom of the Father. He has made him known," end quote. Like Everard, John relies upon God for the illumination that can only be seen with the help of God. But at the same time, the ideal reader, like the ideal playgoer, gets a good deal of help from the gospel or playwright. Like Mary compared to light, where memory is given a workout so as to be able to imagine what is being said via sweet eloquence, so in the Gospel of John, memory is exercised, even trained to remember rightly. In fact, John's Gospel is an intriguing extended work of vivid speech in this regard, precisely to carry off this memory training. Again, Quintilian is worth recalling. The effect of rhetor prompts memory so as to awaken emotion and hence persuasion. The effect of rhetor works within an arena of shared memory and thus controls memory for the correct outcome. John's Gospel is, from start to finish, a piece of memory work. Jesus comforts his disciples on the night of his arrest and departure back to the Father via crucifixion that unless he leaves, the Paraclete cannot come. Quote from John 14, 25 to 26, "These things I have spoken to you while I'm still with you, but the Paraclete, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he will teach you all things and bring to your remembrance all I have said to you." End quote. So it's not just a bit of random recollection we overhear when earlier in the Gospel, after Jesus, after cleansing the temple and facing his accuser, prophesies, quote, "Destroy this temple, in 3 days I will raise it up." Chapter 2, verse 19, a reference to his resurrection, of course. But more important is what the narrator tells us. Quote, "When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken," end quote. As the gospel unfolds in its entirety, the whole of the narrative, it appears to me, is a spirit-inspired narrative centered in the testimony of the beloved disciple, or purports to be. The whole of the gospel becomes an imaginative work of vivid speech designed to awaken narratively laden images, prompt emotional participation, and thus win assent. The ideal listener participant, if gestating, as Professor Bloomquist argues, is learning how to see, what to imagine, and even what to experience in the task of being reborn. I think you and I profoundly disagree about that. If I interpret his paper correctly, Professor Bloomquist is inclined to read John's Gospel text designed to offer listeners a means of rebirth. I wonder if the Gospel is, however, as outwardly oriented as his reading might suggest. The 20th chapter of John's Gospel, arguably an earlier ending before chapter 21 was added, fittingly for John, leaves the interpreter in question. The manuscript variants allow it to end with the words, "Either these things are written that you may come to believe, or these things are written so that you may continue to believe." A text that situates itself amidst a kind of sacred remembering, that awards itself a kind of hieratic origin, that trades in knowledge, that makes the blind see and the sighted blind, reads to be more as a text for insiders with a shared sacred memory, a community that is not so much gestating as already reborn into the esoteric mode of seeing John offers his listeners. It may be true that the implied readers are offered a womb with a view, but in that womb they see and overhear vivid stories that train them to see what's worth looking at and listen to and what is worth remembering, all in the service of imagination and religious participation. Further, it's important also to situate this seeing in a social context. When Jesus criticizes the Jews, who are usually, but not always, regrettably, identified as temple officials, he is cast out. Tellingly, for a community living, one could argue, sometime near the end of the first century, we overhear a story of a man born blind who comes to see, and after cross-examined by the temple authorities and the temple, no less, he is cast out, apos synagogen, to cast out. Literally, from the assembly, from the synagogue. Indeed, it is only after he is cast out that Jesus, who has vanished from the narrative after the healing, appears again to the sighted blind man. It's only here that he appears again to the sighted blind man. This has prompted many debates about the relationship of Johannine Judaism to late first century Judaism, an unbelievable expulsion of the church from the synagogue, as though either of those things were at all self-evident phenomena at the end of the first century, whether John is anti-Jewish, and so on. What is important from the perspective of a religious text like the Gospel of John is that memory here seems to me to be political. It is social, and it is embodied in history. Memory is for the sake of definition, whether readers of John were indeed evicted from a synagogue or like to imagine themselves as having been evicted from a synagogue. The one awaiting to be born a second time is awaiting also a political rebirth, a social one, and one coming out into Jesus' light, a new way of seeing into a harsh world of opposition, crucifixion, and misunderstanding. Imagination here serves not purely devotional or theological purposes and applications, but oppositional, socially discordant, and competitive ones. My last paragraph. To conclude, if it's the case, in the words of the orientation of the Sawyer Seminar, quote, that exegetical images prove crucial to understanding how meaning was constituted visually, end quote, then that insight must be extended slightly to say that exegetical images also prove crucial to understanding how meaning is constituted in a visual community of interested seers who see for political and social ends and aims, and whose seeing expresses their social material location and their interests. Who the seers are is as important as what they see. Who they are determines, as Quintilian and others well knew, how they should see, what virtues they should follow, and what vices to avoid. Sweet eloquence always comes speaking on a soapbox.
Thank you very much, Harry. Well, what I suggest now is let's give Greg and Bart a chance to respond to Harry's insights, and then everyone else can participate in the discussion. So, Greg, did you want to just...
I'm happy to have others just have participate, too. So I'm.
And you, Bart?
Yes, please, yeah.
Oh, okay. Chris.
So I had a question for Professor Ramakirk. And, you know, at the risk of delving too deeply into historical specifics, I was wondering if you have entertained the idea or given any thought whatsoever to connections between this sacred representation here and the... what we might consider a minor crisis in representation, in Marian representation, that comes in the wake of the proclamation of the Immaculate Conception in 1476, with Sixtus IV proclaiming the Immaculate Conception, it opens up a new realm of Marian iconography that, at least in Italy, leads to a certain struggle to work through images that are both poetically beautiful and satisfying, but also theologically grounded. And so you have, on the one hand, Raphael going for things like the Madonna Foligno and, you know, the Virgin appearing on a half moon or a sun or whatever it is. And then you have other artists like Mazzolino and Ferrara, who, you know, basically like tries to kill analogy by putting a rather boring virgin in the center of an image, and then little devices recalling all of the metaphors that are used to describe the virgin's immaculate nature. And so I was wondering, you know, the question of clarity, the question of the virgin as light, shows up in a lot of the immaculatist literature and images from this period. So is there something immaculatist that might be at work here? Is there, could we even perhaps imagine that maybe one of the tableaux vivants is somehow an immaculatist image?
I have to disappoint you by saying that I haven't contemplated this thought, but that it's worthwhile doing that. And I make a reference, I think, to the Immaculate Conception somewhere on one of the pages, but I haven't. It is something worthwhile. I haven't come across actually a lot of art historical literature on how the Immaculate Conception was expressed in the Northern art. I mean, you're an Italianist, obviously.
Yes.
But that is certainly something to look into. Like it is also, I mean, it is obvious, of course, that I could have made references to rhetorical theory and to Quintilian. The book by Webb is a gold mine of yeah. Especially on the theory of inner Gaia, of course, on vividness.
Yeah, right.
And I've done that or not. I could make references to some publication I could refer to. So there are many. I could try and find some evidence for the view. It would have been wonderful if we had had more plays from that particular competition in which different imagery was used for Mary. So there might be a link to the Immaculate Conception and to the theory, but I'm not sure about that.
I have something to say to that.
Actually, yes,
because I think it's a very good question, and it actually just sort of passingly flitted through my mind, precisely we don't have quite the engagement with Immaculist imagery in the North before, I would say before the mid-16th century, and then when Kinesius publishes his great treatise of the Virgin, it suddenly changes everything, and the floodgates open in the North as well. But one thing that really fascinated me, I mean, the passage from Proverbs and the passage from Ecclesiasticus that come up in your paper become commonplaces of Franciscan Immaculist defense. But what was surprising to me was Evard's analogy of the Virgin to the light on the first day of creation, which is not standard
in
Immaculist defenses, and in fact is, as far as I can tell, completely original to Evard. And I was really very surprised by how theologically original this layman, this layperson is, and what
maybe
kind
they thought of, it too original, since he didn't win any prize for this.
Well, I mean, it reminds me of what people say.
There was a theologian.
People like this, what is to some extent familiar to them, and this was something that clearly was not, this analogy was not familiar to them. But there are all sorts of curious things going on. I mean, not only is that analogy very surprising on theological grounds, but what happens in the 18th analogy of the play is very, very surprising. Because as you point out, the analogy is no longer of the Virgin to Clarehate, it's of the Virgin to Air, it's of the Virgin to Look. So you've been dealing with Licht this whole time, and suddenly you're dealing with Look, I mean, you're dealing with something else entirely, and the analogy is no longer of the Virgin to Light, because Light is now transferred analogically to Christ rather than to the Virgin, though it's the Light of the fourth day of creation, not of the first day of creation, and the Virgin is converted into something else. In other words, by transferring that analogy to Christ, you convert the Virgin from light into air. And then air becomes the vessel from which comes forth the light of Christ. That is, this is a completely different way of construing visually what has been going on in the basic analogy of the Virgin to the first light. So the first light. So something very, very curious is going on there. And when you get to analogy 18, suddenly none of the analogical culture, which in a way you have been inhabiting in the play, is completely dismantled, and something else happens.
Well, I don't know whether, of course he turns things around, but it's, I mean, there still is this very strong link, even in the 18th analogy, between Mary and the primordial light, I think, the Genesis 1:3. I mean, you can still connect her identification with our aerial sphere, with that first day of creation. Well, I have to look into that.
You know what I would call that? I would call that a blending. I mean, that's what's going on, to use a theoretical instrument that actually I think Greg, you use so well, Harry, you use so well, you well too. It's not spelled out. I mean, there's something enthymematic about that. That is, there are several analogies that are embedded in that analogy that allows you to say, well, yes, it is actually still consistent, but it's only consistent if you move through two further analogies, which allow you to see that, in fact, there is an analogy of Look to Licht that is allowing you to make this further analogy in 18.
I've been hesitant a long time, because there is this interpretation of Licht with light. And I put it in a footnote. In West Flemish, Licht can mean light. In that case, the 18th analogy, if Mary is then still compared to light instead with air. But since he uses the word Licht, the term Licht as well, it's not
exactly.
It's not conceivable that
yes.
And I still it is a I should have someone look at that from a linguistic point of view. But I'm still convinced that aerial sphere is or heaven is more fitting here.
Dr. Ramkar. Perhaps tangential to your paper, but of great interest to me, is the compelling connection between homiletics and the art that you talked about. And what I'm really interested in learning is how, when you are looking at a 16th century artist and looking then at Bernard de Clairvaux and Pierre Lombard from maybe four centuries earlier, then how? What do we tell, or you know, what do we know about how their homiletical theory then is impacting artists in the 16th century? And then also, it is clear that Luther then was accessing Bernard Clairvaux. That's one way maybe at getting at this. But what else do we know about how those earlier works in homiletics were impacting the thought centuries later?
Again, difficult to say. But how did, I mean, I refer to Bernard and to Lombard only when it concerns their ideas on Mary or their ideas on light, not their ideas on preaching and sermon making. Where did these rhetoricians get their ideas about sermon making from? That again is, of course, there are, I mean, we have medieval artes predicandi, of course, that we could certainly look at and try to figure out if what the rhetoricians did in these kind of comparisons and in other plays, actually, for that matter, in some way could have been inspired by sermon theory, contemporary sermon theory. It is always difficult. That's why I, at some point, clearly said, it's very unclear whether Everard actually had first-hand knowledge of someone like Bernard or Peter Lombard. I mean, we know of you can go into a book ownership in Bruges at the time, and then you'll find that there were monasteries and convents that had manuscripts of Peter Lombard. But did he have direct access to? I don't know whether there actually were editions. There must have been printed editions by that time of the censuses of Lombard, I think, early 16th century. But did he have direct access to that? Did he? That is always difficult. It's so easy, of course, to get textbooks and source books and pick out all these wonderful ideas by Lombard and Bernard and all the other authorities he mentioned. But you never know how he exactly, where he got this information from exactly. That makes it always difficult. I would love to be able to look at this study and find out whether he followed the notebook system actually, or every once in a while took out the book from one of the libraries, like we know Ruspel did in Brussels. Unfortunately, we do not know.
Many of us in early Christianity have become even more interested in Mary since the discovery and the translation of the Gospel of Mary. And one of the really interesting things in the Gospel of Mary in relation to your paper, first of all, call you Dr. Rumakers, is that Mary is functioning as mind. Mm-hmm. She is above the disciples. And I was interested, and there's obviously influence in the Gospel of Mary from the Gospel of John. And this is where I wanted to ask you, Greg, your perception of the role of Mary or the function of Mary in relation to the tomb. Because Gospel of Mary is really working on and expanding the resurrected Jesus' meeting of Mary in John 20 when she's there in the garden weeping. And then Jesus speaks to her things. And it doesn't describe what he says to her. Right? But then the Gospel of Mary then purports to tell us what it is that the resurrected Jesus has spoken to her. So she seems... Okay, I'm interested in this from two standpoints. In the Protoevangelium of James, Mary functions as womb that gives birth to light. So her virginity is retained because she doesn't give birth in the usual way. It's fascinating in relation to Greg, you're wondering about the function of womb that will give second birth, so, because Mary is womb in Proto-James, but then she is not noticeably womb in the Gospel of John, nor in the Gospel of Mary. Namely, she has become vision person or mind person who is above the male disciples. Then she knows things about the heavens. She can see things in the realm of the invisible that the disciples are unable to see. I'd like to hear, first of all, a comment from you, Greg, about your perception of the role of Mary in the Gospel of John in this womb image.
I wondered which Mary you were talking about. I wondered which Mary you were talking about, because, of course, there are only two Marys in the Gospel of John. Mary of Bethany and Mary of Magdala.
Yes.
The mother of Jesus is never named.
Yes.
So if you're talking about, I think you were actually blending two, at least two. If you're talking about, first of all, Mary, sorry, if you're talking, first of all, about the mother of Jesus, it is curious that there are very various characters within John who are named. There are some who aren't, it's true. But the fact that the mother of Jesus is not named, if the rotography of John is as I've said, seems to me to be significant. Because in fact, there is not to be any focus on that gestational nature, to use your term, of the role of Jesus' mother. There is no birth narrative. There is no indication of how this being came into existence. He's not even described as a man. John the Witnesser is described as a man. Jesus is described as the Word that's become flesh. So there's a gestational nature to the whole of the Gospel in which Jesus is actually born a second time. And that's where the emphasis is on the birth of the second from the second time from the empty tomb. The mother of Jesus plays a distinctly insignificant role of, at the very most, pointing to how others should approach this Jesus. The other Mary that you're talking about, I don't think you really were touching on Mary of Bethany, who is the sister of Martha, who is the sister of Lazarus, who may or may not be historical characters. As I think you know from reading the paper, there is a tradition that the Lazarus being spoken of is in fact Eleazar, one of the last high priests of the temple of the Sadducean period. And that in fact, we know that this Eleazar had two sisters, Mary and Martha. And there is some evidence that, in fact, this Lazarus, who is the one who, if there were ever a rumor to go around that the beloved disciple is one who will never die again, there's only one other person in the Gospel of whom that could be said, and that would be Lazarus, who has already died once. So in John 21, why would he possibly die again? Right? And so it's led some scholars like Ben Witherington and others to talk about the beloved disciple, that is the one who stands behind the Gospel, as Lazarus. Because it makes sense. makes sense. And if that is the case, then really the audience about which Harry was speaking is in fact probably more likely than not an audience of people who are associated in some way with the temple. So the temple is not just, as I've spoken about it, a frame for discussion of the gospel. It's not just the rhetorical problem that the gospel is faced with. It's also very likely temple personnel who are the audience of the gospel. I'll come back to that in just a moment because I have a question for Harry in light of that. But the third person that you're really, and I think this is the person you may be interested in, is Mary of Magdala, right? Who suddenly appears out of nowhere, who has no appearance earlier in the gospel, who has, unlike the synoptic tradition, she's not there previously. She's suddenly there at the end. She looks into the empty tomb and sees something that only the priest could see in the Holy of Holies, which is the slab on which the Ark of the Covenant once had rested, overshone by two angelic figures, two cherubim at either end. The audience, the rhetorical audience, reads this and sees through her eyes something that almost assuredly she does not see. The importance of what her role is, however, it seems to me, is one, that she sees something that is passed on to the rhetorical audience that sees this and says, wow, this is too clear of an echo to be coincidence. I'm always astonished when commentary doesn't see more of this because it's actually not very commented on. But the second thing is, it's of course the word of Jesus that speaks to her, the word of now the risen Jesus who speaks to her, by which she recognizes who she is. Her vision has not caused her to see who he is. She has looked, she has said, you must be the gardener. Her vision has shown her nothing. Her vision has shown the rhetorical reader a scene that the rhetorical reader understands. Her own understanding isn't there until the word of Jesus comes with, which speaks her name, and then there's recognition. And that seems to me to be the essence of the use of Mary as a figure in the end. It's one who is poised for birth, a believer who is poised for birth, has not yet been born, but who is poised for birth, who is poised to follow this Jesus now, this risen Jesus out of the tomb, out of the womb. And so the expansion of that, you get the same kind of expansion in the synoptic traditions with expansions on the infancy narratives in the synoptics and Protoevangelium James, infancy gospel of Thomas, etc., etc., etc. Of course you're going to get expansions on these very enigmatic, oblique moments where you wish the text said more, but it doesn't. And so it's not surprising that subsequent authors begin to fill in the blanks of, well, what did Jesus say to her in the intervening period? He certainly must have said something to her. You don't look satisfied, though.
Yeah.
You're okay with that? What was it I was going to say maybe I'll come back to it, because there was something I was going to pick up from that answer in response to you, but maybe I'll think of it again.
That's another one of those episodes that I think your paper was fabulous, but it your reading is just so very different from the kind of exegetical stuff I work with in the 16th and 17th centuries, and to some extent because you're engaging so emphatically with the Jewish tradition, and I mean what happens. I think in the visual arts and also in much of the exegetical literature I've looked at is that episode is in some ways like the episode of Christ and the woman taken in adultery. Yeah. I mean, she doesn't recognize him, she hears him, but then she turns around and sees. I mean, implicitly, the way my people are reading that is then she sees him. Mm-hmm. You know, she doesn't see him, but she sees him, but she does not see him, and then her corporeal vision is reconciled to her spiritual vision. And just to go back to your Augustinian model of the tripartite scheme of the relation of the corporeal to the register of imagination to the register of intellection, I mean, Augustine does not think of those as three discrete and demarcated stages. He thinks of them as continuous. Mm-hmm. And so you would go from intellection, you would circle back through the... I mean, those things are ultimately reconcilable. And I think that when reading those two episodes from John, my people see those two episodes as a scriptural justification for the compatibility of corporeal vision and spiritual vision. It's not that
one excludes
or demarcates the other. They become reconciled in those two episodes.
Absolutely.
And those episodes are very much then about vision.
And one can do that with those two episodes, but if you then go on to the next episode in the 20th chapter with Thomas, of course it is Thomas who asks for the visual proof of Jesus rather than believing the word of those who have spoken. And when Jesus does appear and speaks to Thomas, interestingly enough, he says, Thomas, you want to see? He said, see and put your hands there. And of course, everyone usually says, well, he did. And of course, he doesn't put his hands, but he does see. And then Jesus gives these last words of the gospel in its form as we have it, which is 1 to 20, with the chapter 21 being added subsequently. You know, you've seen and you've believed. That's great. But how much more blessed are those who believe without seeing? And I think, given that that's the last word of Jesus from the gospel, followed by the narrator's statement, these things are written so that you may either believe or go on believing, I think it doesn't put the lie to your people. But what it does is undercuts their interpretive understanding of the texts of the two women in the way that they've done it. Mm-hmm. It undercuts it. It allows for some reinterpretation. Once having heard, now we can see something. And that's true. But so too would that be with Jesus and Thomas, but it doesn't end that way. And Jesus simply says to Thomas, it's great that you've seen, but so much more blessed are those who believe without seeing. I can't think of a more lucid text for talking about the valuelessness of seeing.
You're completely right, and I think that some of the homiletic and some of the meditative literature and some of the exegetical literature, that is a big challenge to them. But they try to rise to that challenge.
Yeah.
But it is clearly a challenge, which is how do you reconcile that episode with the other two episodes? But they try to do it.
I know, that's a great way to put it. That's a very generous way to put it, too. I like that. It says as much about you as it says about them. The generosity of your...
Oh.
Windows, but returning to last week, chose grisaille windows instead to make a difference about their position on the visual arts, and I thought that might be interesting for some aspect.
I've been looking at the text. I mean, it would have been wonderful, of course, if he would have referred to that particular analogy, but he doesn't.
Yes, maybe the first prize winner.
Yeah. Yes, maybe, exactly. Maybe that's the reason why...
Because it's simple, it's practical.
Yeah.
It's not actually visualizable. And so it would work perfectly in the contest. Hmm.
Thank you. Yeah, all right.
For those of us who are not experts in this period, I wondered if you could describe these play contests or competitions a little bit more.
Yeah.
From the perspective of Sweet Eloquence always being on her soapbox, you know, I'm wondering what the stakes were in those competitions. How was a winner decided? If that's even what happened.
Well, there were winners and losers, and these competitions were part of a culture that started in the. I mean, of course, if you look at French rhetoricians' culture, go to the priests, the Marian priests. I mean, that already started in Arras, I think, in the 13th century. I mean, extremely early, at least in my perception as a Césarmiste, that is extremely early. But in rhetorician's culture, it started somewhere in the 15th century and went on until the 17th century. And these competitions were, I mean, there was always a clear question or theme that was formulated, which they all had to answer. And usually in the invitation, which was a written, printed invitation sent around to all sister organizations. And it depended a little bit whether you would only invite. You could have a local competition for which you would also only invite the local chambers of rhetoric, but then you could have a regional competition with all the Flemish or all the Brabantine, or maybe a competition for which in Holland there have been competitions. And in these invitations, you could also indicate, for example, whether you would like how long it had to be the play, how many characters, how many tableaux vivants should be shown. So people got very, and then there were many genres in which they actually competed. Here we have indications that they only competed in the form of plays, but then we have competitions not linked, associated with any religious festival, but really literary competitions or event contests for which there were competitions in a number of genres, plays, but also poems, all sorts of poems. Is there anything more you want? Is that an answer to your question? Or?
Yeah, no, it's wonderful to know about the possible constraints that are imposed with the invitation. So how was a winner decided?
That is, well, we can only speculate. We don't have any, jury, what is it, reports or...
Ballots, yeah.
Ballots, exactly. We don't have that. We sometimes know about conflicts that arose from... Mm. The fact that one chamber got a prize and the other didn't, and but that is not enough to actually establish why exactly. We can only guess.
But it sounds like it was professional opinion, not popular acclaim.
There were juries. We certainly knew that. It is not like Dancing with the Stars or whatever. where you have a popular jury. Okay. That no, there were professional juries, and from some of these contests, we know actually. Well, we know from a Harlem contest in which it was either Goltzius or Fomondo was part of the jury. So, I mean, we know about artists too. That, well, the involvement of artists is always very interesting, of course, because they would not only look at rhetorical or verbal or literary quality, but also, of course, would watch. Sometimes we think it's the number of tableau vivants that was awarded, because but there was always that's a detail that might interest you. They always said in invitations that they should set up a play, devise a play that was uncostly. So I mean, you could not get a prize for having the most lavish plays. That was a bit, because then the larger and more and richer chambers of rhetoric had an advantage when compared to the smaller ones that came from villages. I mean. That's the most fascinating aspect of this. I mean, this was a competition in Nieuport or Voorne, which were very small coastal towns. And the participating chambers, some of them came from Bruges, of course, but others came from hamlets, so very, very, very small villages that had their own chambers of rhetoric. And so they didn't have the same money that chambers from Bruges had.
That does sound like it was something of an insider audience that was deciding.
That is great. That is, and we always, of course, wonder how large the audience was that actually watched these. Was it only the rhetoricians themselves or the members of the chambers of rhetoric and their entourage that formed the key audience, or was there a larger audience around that key audience? That is hard to say.
Yeah, I wanted to return for a second to the Gospel of John. I'm not a New Testament scholar at all. I was curious, you talked about the problem of visualization, of visualizing the word And as I was listening to you, I was thinking, which word exactly? I mean, in the evocation, and of course, I'm thinking that, that a certain kind of conception of the word that shows up in John is obviously also influenced by sort of notions of the Logos that also tie into the Stoic traditions as well. But I'm curious in terms of understanding how the word in John is different from the, you know, from the origination of words and saying, basically, in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
What is different about that word, and what would explain its sort of spirited character? Because it is not as if God in Genesis does not move around as that spirit that sort of hovers over the water. I mean, it is lacking no energy and in some sense, spirit. But it seems as if something is changing in the particular way of understanding that spirit and also linking it with the discourse of light. So I wonder
mm-hmm.
if you could mm-hmm. talk a little bit, sort of unpack that a little bit further.
It would be. You say you're not a New Testament scholar. It would be wonderful if New Testament scholars asked those kind of sophisticated questions. It's nice. First of all, I think one thing that needs to be said, and this is interesting in relation to Barth's paper. There's a phrase in Barth's paper that in which he talks about the relationship between John 1 and Ecclesiasticus 4, and you referred to this, 24, in which the words come out of the mouth of God. The words come out of the mouth of God. And that's not an image that seems to be at home in John's gospel. The word, as you've said very correctly, think of the word more as something which in the rhetor's diaphragm, close to the rhetor's heart and within the rhetor, in the rhetor's breast, in other words, the logos is generated. That is, not the words coming out of the mouth, not those things that make my lips move, but the thing that gives meaning to, whether it be a word, a sound, or nothing, is there. That's really what John is relying on. A word that, even if God doesn't speak it in the temple from above the ark, where the invisible God is to be, you know the word is still present. It's like a volcano. It's like generating something. And then only later do you get the smoke and shock and awe. The shock and awe is not the word. It's that which lies deep within. And that's why the verse that Professor Meyer read, John 1:18, the only one who has ever seen God is in the bosom of the Father. That's where the word is generated. That's where the logos is generated. And I think that's one of the differences between the tradition of the Second Temple period that Jesus appears in and the kind of understanding of word that John is dealing with. The Torah is words. It's inscriptions on stone. It's like Jesus writing on the sand. The Torah is utterances. There are good words in Greek for utterances. Things that are said, make the lips move. Things that you can jot down, like cuneiform script or like ink on paper. That's not what John is talking about. But that is something that he contrasts with the word throughout. And that is, those are clues. Those can be clues pointing to the word, but they are not the word themselves. The Torah is not the word. The Torah can even point to the word if you read it correctly. It's like working backwards from the speech to the genesis of the logos in the bosom of the Father. How would you do that? How would you go backwards from speech to the heart of the Father? These are the kind of questions that John presents the reader imaginatively with, that both in historical critical scholarship, scholars have wanted to know, the genesis of the community and the configuration of the community. John isn't interested in that. The medieval tradition is, in fact, closer to what and you've pointed this out very accurately, the medieval tradition is actually much closer to what John is trying to get at. What's going on when you trace back the words? So this is why the words that Jesus might speak to Mary in the end, that doesn't matter. Now, you might say to me, well, that's counterintuitive, isn't it? Because all the dialogues of Jesus, it just goes on and on and on and on. And I think that is counterfactually so, because shouldn't you, at the end of this gospel, which is so full of superfluous words from Jesus, shouldn't you have absolutely no reason at all not to believe? That's the question that's asked in the very last verses of the gospel. I could write more, but surely, this is overmuch. If you really want to believe, all I would have need to have said was one word. That would have been enough. It would have been your name, as to Mary. That's all the Logos would have needed to say. So you get this superfluous abundance that's unnecessary. But for heaven's sakes, I guess that's true, it should show you something about what the Logos is in the bosom of the Father, where the Logos is always at home. Is it a follow-up?
A follow-up question.
Go ahead.
Really referring to how Logos then engages with the idea of law and grace, especially in the beginning. Mm-hmm. What relationship do you see between that understanding of word as this birthing versus the Torah?
Sure. Excellent question. Excellent and insightful question. Obviously, if you think of law, it's just as I've been describing it, that comes from Moses. Law came from Moses, the narrator says at the very beginning, either the same narrator or another. But grace and truth have come through Jesus Christ. So in other words, law comes from one who had the experience, as the gospel goes on later to say, of actually encountering the word. The expression used throughout John uniquely in the canonical traditions, I am the bread of life, I am the truth, I am the way, is more properly translated, I am is the way, I am is the bread of life, I am. So it's the name of God revealed to Moses. And there's a point in the tabernacle's experience at which Jesus says both Moses has encountered him and Abraham has encountered him, and of course, which is clearly, you know, nonsense, because how could it be? Moses has encountered God, but what comes forth from Moses is law, which is subordinated to God. I am the Word. And this is why I think you get a comparison between the law was given through Moses. The law was given through Moses, but grace and truth have come into being. Grace and truth have come into being through Jesus Christ. The same expression used for the Word made flesh. So it's as if to say, I mean, without this one who has come into being, there would be not even grace and truth. And so what you want to probably go away with from that is something. After reading the gospel, you would say something like, well, that means that the Torah only has a relative significance. I mean, to put it simply, that the Torah can only have a relative significance. And as I've described it here, that significance is essentially supposed to be clues toward what you should. But to rely on the Torah as if that were the final statement about what matters, which is what the rabbis were saying, manna and water, all of these elements from the scriptures themselves are pointing to is they're pointing to Torah spiritualized, Torah symbolically signified. If there's one of the great church fathers who caught this, I think it was not only Augustine, but I think it was also Origen, who is accused of being an allegorist for no good reason. In fact, what Origen was doing, in fact, was very much the kind of exegetical interpretive approach that I've taken here, working from the visual to that which is like the visual, but symbolic, and that's like law, to what actually really is, but is invisible and can only be known through belief. But even then, you can't see it. You're only poised for birth to see it when, at a particular point, that will become visible with the new eyes that you will have. And that's, you know, where I would disagree. I don't think that these texts aren't talking about gestation as having been born. They're not talking about anyone in here who has been born. They're talking about people, as I said in the paper, who are poised to be born, or people who are poised to remain in the womb. Anyway, sorry, that's way too long. Too many words. See, this is what happens with too many words.
Professor Bloomquist, I had a question, not about John, but about more the a methodology question about your paper. And this actually is a question more broadly about retography. And one of the things that I continue to wrestle with when I engage that topic is kind of the slipperiness of terms like image, picture. And of course, these things can mean a lot of different things, and it's quite understandable that there's a lot of slippage. We can have mental images, we can have images as physical paintings or sculptures, and we, of course, can have images as words, verbal imagery. And so sometimes I lose track a little bit in retography about what's what and what is the image that's producing the argument, or is the argument producing the image. And sometimes I think that's just somewhat unavoidable. These terms tend not to stay in their cages. But sometimes I think there's some confusion. For instance, just in the beginning of your work, you talked. I love this idea of this exercise of visualizing God. But you mentioned that because of the anachronism of Islam and Israelite religion, that this would be really hard to do. But only in a sense of maybe a physical image. And even there might be some controversy. But surely the ancient Israelites imagined their deity, or visualized their deity in anthropomorphic form. They certainly wrote about, figuratively, the deity in anthropomorphic form. So in all those senses, of course, they could visualize their deity. But maybe they didn't materialize their deity.
Wonderful, wonderful comment. And it actually builds on a comment that was made this morning at the session we had on methodology. And Chris made a very similar comment. And I think it does suggest, and Professor Robbins and I were talking about this earlier, that we really need to be careful with our language, obviously, in terms of others who are reading this outside of our work and where what we're saying can be read and verified by those who are working in the field of visual imagery. Now, interestingly enough, I just go back. Your name is?
Ryan.
Ryan, just to go back a moment to what you were saying about the Jewish or Islamic world, and you said, well, it's not impossible for them to have an image of God. I would agree with you. But is it possible for them to have a visual take on God? And that's where Chris, I think, made a very good point this morning. If we're talking about an ocular take on God, I think the answer is no. If you're talking about an image, that is a mental image in which I can blend elements of things that I know from whatever source it is about God, then I think, yeah, we can probably say we can have an image. Now, we talk about, is that a mental image? Is it a visual image? And, we'll work on the language. And you're right to press, as Chris was right to press this morning, that question of what do we mean when we say a visual image? But I think your pointing to this line on the aniconism is a good one, because it does say, well, could you do something like what John does and have Vernon Robbins say, now, ocularly, show me God, or light, or life. Not sources of light, not blended light, light itself, life itself, God himself, God herself, God itself. Beginning, no. You can have images, though. And that's, I think, where we need to refine the language more.
Well, just to follow up with that.
Go ahead.
I'm interested.
Go ahead, Ryan.
I come from the field of Hebrew Bible. And there's actually really interesting and lively debates about if there were actual ocular images.
Yeah,
so,
interesting.
So not just the verbal and not just the mental, but...
Interesting.
I'm actually persuaded that in one way or another, there actually were.
In what period of time were we talking?
I mean, any time in the late Iron Age, into the Persian. might not have looked. I'll say this. When we define an image of Yahweh, say, in a very particular way, let's say anthropomorphically, then I'm not so persuaded that we have archaeologically examples of those images. But I think I wonder, at least, is it possible that the Israelites or whoever saw their deity in images that we might not label as Yahweh?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, and I do. No, it is, but it's also a really good opportunity to continue the dialogue. But there is something interesting that does connect with John's Gospel in what you've said, and that is that students, you know, often have a difficulty of saying, well, then Jesus was God and was visualizable to those people as God. And the answer is, of course, no. The Word became flesh, in a sense masked God as the Word. And when you see Jesus, it's not surprising that there is confusion. Jesus is as much a clue, and his signs is as much a clue to what they're supposed to be poised to believe in as the Hebrew Scriptures, as the witness of John. And I'm talking from chapter 5. As the words that are heard from the heavenly movements, from the Father. Jesus is himself couched in that hidden form that does not allow a sight of him, at least in his pre-resurrection form, a sight of him to be associated with God per se. And that's important because that does seem to fit, if not the entire Hebrew tradition, at least significant components of it. And you may be pointing to, who am I to say, but I mean, obviously, I think the Hebrew tradition was vast. And there were segments in which you would have some who might have said, yes, you could have perhaps an ocular take on God. My guess is the tradition that came through in Hebrew Scriptures, for the most part, says almost assuredly not. But who knows?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm interested in what ocular image you might evoke here. Are you thinking of Ezekiel, for example, who sees a fire and a form? There was something below and above. Is this what you mean by ocular?
Well, I could mean two different things, since I'll be slippery myself with the term.
By all means.
Well, I mean, from an archaeological perspective, there is some stuff, some data, some pictures, some statuettes that we don't know by any means for sure would have been Yahweh, but
so they would be anthropomorphic, you mean?
Some would be, yeah, in one way or another. Although it's very, I mean, I think this is the data that I'm not as persuaded by. But certainly some think that, at least early in Israelite religion, there were such images. I'm actually more interested in thinking about how an Israelite might have seen or visualized what they believed to be their deity in an image that might not have been intended to be that deity. In other words, if Yahweh is known to be described in a certain way, it is known to be a certain form or to have certain features, if they saw an image of something that had those features, is it possible, or would they have thought, Yahweh? Mm-hmm. And granted, they didn't make that image to be that. But this is, again, very speculative, but I wonder if such ways of seeing work in the ancient world that way.
I don't think it's so speculative.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to...
I mean, I wrote a book on the image of Yahweh with wings as drawing from winged sun disk, winged anthropomorphic deities, where the Israelite psalmist sees these images of these winged things protecting various creatures or names, and they associated Yahweh's protection with that image of wings. Hmm. And so it is not saying, you know, Yahweh has wings necessarily all the time, but how do you imagine, how do you picture God's form? The winged form of these ancient deities is a great way to picture God's form. And the Psalms are full of this, of people describing looking at the deity, beholding the deity in Psalm 17, and seeing your face. It happens all the time. So I think it's not quite accurate to say that the majority opinion in the Hebrew Bible is God's got no form, God can't be seen.
Fair enough.
Because God is pictured. It's in fact more interesting that God is pictured in such multifaceted imagery throughout the entire Hebrew Bible, at least, as if to say, you don't concretize God's form, and because of that lack of concretizing God's form, all these other images are evoked, the whole world of images explodes then as potential ways to picture God.
I think that's a very accurate statement. I think it also fits the picture of the temple process being a kind of a solidification of the what I was calling the majority view, which I think you're correct not to say is not to say the majority view, but is there depiction of God in the temple?
Is there a depiction of God in the temple?
Yes.
So I think we would say generally not, but there are other images in the temple.
Fair enough. Other images, yes, but not God.
Yeah.
We have in the Book of Kings, Nehushtan gets pulled out of the temple, right? There's a big sculpture of a snake that for centuries had been inside it.
Interesting.
And also the, you shall have no other gods before me. There's an interpretation of this that I think has actually got some legs to it. I wouldn't put all my eggs in that basket, but you shall have no other gods before me might have been another cult statue. Don't put the statues of other gods in this house, right? And then over time, Israel becomes more and more iconic. You can tell from the Deuteronomistic revisions that at some point in the Persian period, there was a sort of backlash against imagery. The Ark of the Covenant becomes just a box. There's no cherubim on top of it anymore. Whereas before, we had these elaborate depictions of the Ark with these cherubim with the wings on top of it. So there is kind of there are stages of this revisions, but there may have well been a full statue of Yahweh for centuries. It's possible.
One thing that struck me when I was thinking about this notion of the ocular is it often struck me, the question sort of struck me whether this question of figuring God in the synagogue, whether the forms, and we see it actually in relationship to sacred text, where the God sort of manifestation more in forms of patterning, that is to say the patterning of letters, the patterning of certain types of inscription. In other words, it is not within a face, and there I'm not sure. I like very much what you brought up with the idea of shadowing, and I think it continues, actually, to somebody like Luke, where the concept of episkazein and overshadowing, in terms of being sort of Mary being overshadowed, figures this kind of potency, this kind of divine potency, but also protection, and also inseminatory sort of possibility. But I do wonder about the question of the face. In other words, would there be other ways of figuring things, but without this kind of articulation of the face?
Well, we certainly know that there are some cases where the Israelites seem to respond to non-anthropomorphic images as if it were the deity. So there's even some text in the Hebrew Bible that suggests they might have treated the ark that way, even with or without the cherubim on the top of it. And that we would think of as quite abstract, and maybe they didn't, again, conceptualize it as an image of deity, but they certainly respond as if it were. So I think that's a point that it raises a good point about what does something have to look like to constitute a divine image?
But is it really a question of what, is it a question of mimesis? I mean, does it have to represent something, or can it presence?
Sure.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I mean, that seems to be the key thing, right?
But how would we know if an image of Yahweh was mimetic anyway?
Yeah.
I would even address myself.
Well, and it's worth pointing out that since it's the word made flesh, since there's this distancing, bleakness that you've drawn attention to, unlike Byzantine incarnational defenses, God can be a woman.
Yeah. And in fact, it's interesting, the children of God, the offspring of God, are born of God, is oftentimes understood in the tradition, in the commentary certainly, as a male begetting. But the word can mean conceiving. The offspring of God are conceived by God. The word can be either. Yeah.
In the Biblia Polyglotta, the great Bible that Arias Montano mm-hmm. edits and gets published under the patronage of Philip II in Antwerp in the 1560s and early 1570s, he was a great temple scholar. And in fact, he got into big trouble because he was such a good Hebrew scholar. And one of the ways in which, and he was also a draftsman, which is what's so interesting, and his drawings are very much part of his exegetical apparatus in the Polyglot Bible, and there are several engravings of the First Temple. And what screens the Holy of Holies in the First Temple are it's hard to know, either they're planks of wood or they're veils. Hmm. And there are forms, there are inchoate forms that are legible in the grain of the wood and in the weaving of the veils. And they look like they're becoming anthropomorphic forms, but they are not fully legible as anthropomorphic forms. So in other words, the presence of God is generative of images coming into legibility, but not of a finished anthropomorphic image. It's very interesting. This great Hebraist actually invents this way of depicting the presence of God in the First Temple, but he feels it has to be depicted, but it cannot be depicted in a mimetic way. It has to be depicted as an image as coming into presence. We're beginning to run out of time, so I did want to ask a couple of questions. Okay. Before you get to the stage.
I have to answer the questions.
I guess that's going to happen at dinner. But those 18 analogies, mm-hmm. There's one point in your paper where you actually tell us, you distill the 18 mm-hmm. analogies. And I tried over and over again to see if there's a structure.
Did you see one?
See if there's a structure, those 18. I couldn't discern the structure. So I wanted you to comment on that. And then I also wanted to comment on the relationship, the analogical relationship of the two tableaux vivants to each other, and the relationship of the way they function analogically to the function of analogy in the 18 analogies in the play.
Well, the first, of course, the one with Esther, with Queen Esther, mm-hmm. and is not a very, in my view, is just a typological one. I mean, it is. It doesn't have the function. It's not a vision like the second one, of course. So it's I didn't really explain how I just stated that it was a typological, an Old Testament type for Mary's position in heaven. Near to the next to the Trinity, the crowning in heaven, the coronation in heaven. But I could imagine that it functions as it wants to underline the fact that it wants at the end of the prologue he wants to make clear that the audience knows, and that imaginative mind knows, but especially the audience knows, because imaginative mind has not really started asking questions yet. He has only raised two questions, and now 18 more to come. So he wants to make sure that the audience at least knows that this is going to be a play about Mary and her closeness to the Trinity and her position in heaven. That's what he wants to make clear. And the play then, and these 18 analogies that are presented in the play that lead to this particular vision, this mix actually, it's a mix of the woman from Revelations
and this image of Mary and the Son, because there is a mixture of images. That is functions as this kind of visionary image of Mary that is not like all the analogies in the Populum and in the Speculum, readily available to everyone, in a schoolbook way. But that is a kind of vision that you can only reach after having been presented and confronted with these analogies, and have that, as I quoted at some point in the play, which have stirred up his heart, which have actually entered into his heart and have been processed there. Does that answer
it? Well, it answers it. I mean, by that point in the play, the process of analogies becomes so inventive. I mean, it's and you
yes.
start with something that is really
well, that's
quite...
That's a fascinating thing about it. He, at some point, it is even enough to just use a word that rhymes on a word that experiential proof can use to introduce another. I mean, it starts to be evocative. It doesn't have anything to do with a pure logical line of reasoning. Anything can do the trick at that point. Yeah. That was only one question you asked.
No, that's great. I just wanted to thank you all for attending, and I hope we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. I wanted also to thank our excellent commentator for his insights, and our two presenters for their really splendid, splendid papers. Thank you very much.
Well done.
That was a beautiful session.
Great.
Nothing to do with it. You guys are good.